This episode of The Fix has been made possible with support from the Wealthy Her Network, established to champion the diversity of women's wealth with the end goal of better servicing female investors and returning a greater impact for the benefit of everyone.
I think as women in particular, we often sort of contract out our sense of self. We let other people take it hostage. And it's everything from what we're wearing and how we look on an individual day to how we've just done the most recent work or education task. We sort of submit to the judgment of others. And I think it's very important to have a sense of self that is stronger than that.
I'm your host, Michelle King, and you're listening to The Fix, a podcast that shares the stories of women and men who are innovating and taking action to advance equality in the workplace and beyond.
Prime Minister.
Thank you very much, Deputy Speaker, and I rise to oppose the motion moved by the Leader of the Opposition. And in so doing, I say to the Leader of the Opposition, I will not be lectured about sexism and misogyny by this man. I will not. And the government Order. Will not be lectured about sexism Order. And misogyny by this man. Not now, not ever. Because if he wants to know what misogyny looks like in modern Australia, he doesn't need a motion in the House of Representatives. He needs a mirror. That's what he needs.
In October 2012, then Prime Minister of Australia, Julia Gillard, called out Tony Abbott, a former member of the Australian Parliament and then Leader of the Opposition, for sexist commentary and misogyny. Julia's 15-minute speech, which she made during a parliamentary proceeding, gained global media attention and received over 3.2 million views on YouTube. Nearly 7 years later, Julia's famous speech still resonates with women and men, not just in Australia, but all around the world. In today's episode of The Fix, we have the pleasure of hearing from Julia Gillard, who served as the first ever female Prime Minister of Australia from 2010 to 2013. Years after stepping down as Prime Minister, Julia continues to lead the conversation on gender inequality and how women are mistreated in workplaces and society. In this episode, Julia will talk about the lessons she's learned throughout her turbulent and extraordinary career in politics. She'll also share with us how leaders and organizations can better support women and empower them by investing in their education.
I was brought up as a girl in a family that didn't teach me that there were limitations based on gender. In my family, there was just my sister and I. We migrated to Australia with our mother and father, and they taught us to aim high. They didn't tell us that there was any difference between boys and girls when it came to going to university or wanting a career. And because neither of them had finished secondary school, they definitely wanted my sister and I to be able to have the ability to succeed. That attitude, I think, is a foundation stone for the rest of my life. And I did become active in political causes when I was at university, including coming to understand a fair bit about gender inequality and how we needed change in our society if women were to be treated equally. Fast forwarding the clock, I then became the first female deputy prime minister and then the first female prime minister of Australia. And as a result of my experiences in both of those leadership positions, but most particularly being the nation's leader as prime minister, I became intrigued about women and leadership and what is it that still means it's hard to get women through for leadership in all walks of life. And when they get there, often their leadership is viewed through the prism of gender rather than them being fairly evaluated as leaders. And certainly my personal experience was that the gendered insult became a kind of go-to political weapon.
I was also very offended on behalf of the women of Australia when in the course of this carbon pricing campaign, the Leader of the Opposition said, when the housewives of Australia need to do what the housewives of Australia need to understand as they do the ironing. Thank you for that painting of women's roles in modern Australia. And then, of course, I was offended too by the sexism, by the misogyny of the Leader of the Opposition catcalling across this table at me as I sit here as Prime Minister. If the Prime Minister wants to, politically speaking, make an honest woman of herself, something that would never have been said to any man sitting in this chair.
Julia's criticism of sexism in politics came during a debate about whether the Speaker of the House should resign for sending text messages that degraded women. It was the first time an Australian leader, and possibly any world leader, had delivered such an upfront attack on misogyny in public life. Here Julia recalls how her speech came about and the worldwide impact it had.
Really, the story in some ways is kind of a curious one. We in Australian politics have this very rough and tumble section of every parliamentary day called question time, where the opposition without notice can ask questions of the government, and overwhelmingly they get asked of the Prime Minister. And it's pretty loud, lots of interjecting, lots of shouting, lots of theatre. I went into what I thought would be question time on the parliamentary day I gave the misogyny speech. And I knew that issues around sexism were the media story of the day. I had supported a man to become Speaker of the House of Representatives, and it had been subsequently unmasked that he had sent some very sexist text messages, something that I couldn't have known at the time I supported him. But notwithstanding that, I was expecting a rough and tumble question time on whether I was a hypocrite on sexism because I'd supported this man. To my surprise, instead of question time, the Leader of the Opposition moved a motion to have an immediate debate. So what is the misogyny speech is my answer to his opening contribution in that debate. So it was given off the cuff. I wrote down a few notes as he was speaking and then gave the speech. I had with me some material that I'd taken in for question time, including some of the Leader of the Opposition's most sexist quotes. But the speech really came together in my head in a few moments as the Leader of the Opposition was speaking. And I think it's in part that immediacy and that rawness that has attracted people to the speech. I also think it was, you know, a time when we weren't using the misogyny word much. We use it a great deal now, but it wasn't being used that much a few years ago. And so for people to hear a very direct allegation of misogyny sort of took people aback. And I think for many women, it's come to be a speech that, you know, represents what they would have liked to have said themselves in a moment when they themselves experienced sexism, but they either didn't have the comeback on the tip of their tongue or didn't feel empowered to give it, woke up at 3 a.m. sort of thrashing around in the bed saying, oh, I wish I'd said X or Y. And I think that that speech helps, you know, deal with those frustrations and unlock a little bit of a sense of power that it is possible to stand up and name and shame sexism and misogyny.
According to the research from the Global Institute for Women's Leadership, in some areas, the progress we've made on gender equality is reversing. Their research shows that globally, women only make up 25% of senior managers and 15% of corporate board members. In the field of information and communications technology, the percentage of women specialists decreased by 6% from 2006 to 2016. Meanwhile, within the decade, there's only been a 1% increase of women in senior management positions. One of the main reasons for this is a lot of the barriers women face in corporate life often remain invisible. This is why today, Julia works to tackle gender discrimination and inequality head on.
So post all of that, I wanted to more deeply understand gender discrimination and how we best combat it. and that's led me to being the chair of the Global Institute for Women's Leadership at King's College London. We're a research institute. We only launched in April last year, so just over 12 months old. But we really want to deepen the evidence base about what promotes women's leadership and its fair evaluation. And whilst it feels like we've been talking about this for forever, actually, when you search the global research base, the evidence about what works is much thinner than we would like. And it kind of breaks my heart that there's a minute spent or a dollar spent on gender equality initiatives that don't have the maximum impact. So we want to research through and make sure that everything people are doing is really delivering the most change. And at the same time, I've continued a passion which has been with me since those university days for educational equality. From my family home, with parents who, for different reasons, but largely because of poverty, didn't get to finish secondary school, education equality has always been a cause close to my heart. And I know when we look at our world today, where 260 million children are out of school, that the face of the child most likely to be marginalised and left behind is a female face. And so that's led me to chairing the Global Partnership for Education, which is the major multilateral fund that focuses on school education in developing countries, and also to be patron of the Campaign for Female Education, which is an incredibly agile philanthropic organisation, 25 years young, just celebrating its 25th birthday, but with a really effective model for change, and which will support 5 million girls in school in Africa in the next 5 years.
To date, the Campaign for Female Education has impacted 3.3 million marginalised children, with 140,000 young women leading the charge. Here, Julia shares what her work with the Campaign for Female Education means to her and what she hopes to achieve.
So, you know, we work with 67 developing country governments, making sure that they've got a really high quality plan for how their schooling system's going to work. For the lowest income countries, we mobilised resources to support the delivery of the plan. We had our big replenishment event last year in Africa and raised $2.3 billion. Most of that comes from governments through their foreign aid budgets. And it's a very rigorous model for change, but it's a really big systems approach. And that's what we need to solve a problem that's measured at the scale of hundreds of millions. But alongside that big systems approach, there's a real role for philanthropy and for the way that philanthropic organisations, non-government organisations can often chart the course and show what can be achieved. There's more, you know, agility and experimentation ability in such non-government organisations. And when I came to get to understand what CAMFED did, I realised that it's just the best of the best, so rigorous on the evidence, so focused on the transition that education makes in a girl's life in Africa, and then so determined not only to see a girl succeed at school, but to support her through her transition into work or entrepreneurship or the next stage of study. And then all of the girls who have been supported create this alumni, which we call CAMA, and those girls give back and support other girls coming through. So this is really an almost exponential model for change, where the CAMA alumni then support girls in school. And I was just so enthused to see something that had that ability to give back, and which was really supporting women not only to get an education, but to be truly empowered and to think of themselves as leaders. And with the, you know, alumni, CAMA, the women who have been through and been supported, you know you're with women who are strong and powerful, going to change their communities, change their nations, and I ultimately think will change the continent of Africa.
There are numerous organisations like the Global Partnership for Education that invest in the education of young girls and women. This work has far-reaching benefits for women's empowerment, because when women are educated, they're not only able to better support their families, they actually increase their potential to launch businesses, lead governments, and positively contribute to the economy. Here, Julia shares ways we can support and help make this happen.
There's two big ways that people can support this work. People can support the Global Partnership for Education by telling their local political leaders that they want to see their governments support GPE. We rely predominantly on governments making contributions available. We do get very substantial contributions from the UK, the European Union, France, the United States, and the list goes on. There's more than 20 countries that are very big donors to the Global Partnership for Education. But they do that, I think, because they understand that people in their voting public are truly interested and want to see girls in particular succeed and be agents of change. They want to see every child in the world get a fair chance. So, you know, ring your local senator or congressperson and say, this is a great cause, please support it. And then the Campaign for Female Education can be supported directly through the giving of donations, whether that's a personal donation that someone's in a position to make, or whether it's holding a function, you know, bringing together a group of friends, a local community group that can have some sort of fun fundraiser and then make some money available to support CAMFED's work.
Given Julia's work on gender equality, women's empowerment and education, it's clear what her priority areas are. With the tremendous career that she's led both in and out of politics, Julia says that there's power in consistently reminding yourself of what your purpose is.
My big lessons really about leadership, reflecting on my time, I think number one, we live in such a cluttered world, you know, everything seems urgent, everything's pinging at us 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You know, you can go to work and come home completely exhausted and all you've done is cleared your email inbox. You know, that's the nature of life today. And it will continue to be like that unless you take some time, some really quiet thinking, strategic time, and ask yourself some very deep questions about what is your purpose and what you're trying to achieve in your life. The best piece of advice I ever got when I was in politics, I received in the days after I became Prime Minister. So they were pressurised, frenzied days. And a political friend of mine from the United Kingdom rang up and said, congratulations, I know you're just in a whirlwind, but what you've got to do now is find some quiet time, sit down with a sheet of paper and write the purpose of the government you lead, defining its essence, its core, and carry that piece of paper with you. And on the most difficult of days, when everything seems insurmountable, get that piece of paper back out and reread it. And I did precisely that. And it wasn't easy to find the time. And there is a real difference between thinking you know in your head what your purpose is and then finding the words to express it and put it down on a piece of paper. But I did find the process very clarifying, and I kept that crumpled sheet with me for the whole time that I was Prime Minister, transferring it in and out of handbags as it got more and more dog-eared. But on the worst of days, I would get it back out and reread it, and it did make a huge difference. It was a great way of steadying myself and centering myself, and I think that's a wonderful piece of advice for anyone, no matter what walk of life they're in.
When it comes to better supporting women, Julia shares what she would like to see from organisations and leaders.
I think the ask of organisations and leaders today is to take gender equality and all forms of diversity seriously. This isn't, you know, feel good, it's not boutique, it's not one day of the year where you have a women's leadership program or some event. It's core business every day, and leaders should be measured and held accountable, including in terms of their remuneration and reward structure, for getting the job done on gender and diversity. And more generally, we need to make sure that leaders who then are taking all of this seriously have the best of evidence in front of them about what works. And that's the mission of the Global Institute for Women's Leadership. We need people leading from the top. There's some great evidence out there already around things that work and make a difference. People can start investing in them tomorrow. And then through research endeavours, including what we're doing at the Global Institute for Women's Leadership, we want to expand that toolkit so people have got an even more profound way of bringing change.
Finally, Julia shares her message to women on how they can overcome some of the challenges they face in school or at work.
One piece of advice I would give is to think very carefully about your sense of self. I think as women in particular, we often sort of contract out our sense of self. We let other people take it hostage. And it's everything from what we're wearing and how we look on an individual day to how we've just done the most recent work or education task. We sort of submit to the judgment of others. And I think it's very important to have a sense of self that is stronger than that. And as Prime Minister, I had to work on that. I fundamentally knew I was the same person with the same mix of strengths and weaknesses. You know, I was still the same Julia Gillard, whether the headlines were good or were bad. And so I had to kind of take power over my own sense of self rather than feeling good on a day of good news and bad on a day of bad news. I couldn't contract out my sense of self. And I think, you know, in the world in which we live, where you don't have to be a publicly exposed figure to scroll through social media and see dreadful things said about you, taking that power over your own sense of self is really important and gives you the kind of resilience you need to be on the leadership journey.
I think the greatest takeaway for me from my conversation with Julia is the power of finding your voice and using it, especially when it comes to tackling sexism and discrimination at work. Not everyone is in a position to do this, which is why it's so important that we advocate for one another by speaking up. In today's Wealthy Her Weekly Fix, we're joined by Georgina Guy, Head of International Strategic Advisory from Brown Advisory and a member of the Wealthy Her Network. Here, Georgina shares her fix.
Hello, everyone. My name is Georgie Guy, and I'm a client advisor at Brown Advisory. I wanted to share some thoughts today on risk, planning, and time. I believe there's always room for a plan to help us achieve our goals and mitigate risks. The Wealthier Report 2019 found that 71% of women surveyed believe men to be more willing to take financial risks than women. I believe that that can have a serious impact on a woman's savings. In fact, particularly for younger women who may be at the beginning of their savings plan, not taking enough risk could be as harmful as taking too much risk. One way to combat the fear of taking a financial risk is to make a plan. Whatever your goals are for your wealth, a carefully thought out plan over time, balanced with an appropriate level of risk, can make your savings and investments very meaningful over the long term. It seems basic, but many people don't do it. You can start with a fairly simple analysis of your income and expenditure, giving you the ability to keep some cash aside for everyday operating needs. Then assess a breakdown of your goals and categorize them by time horizon with a plan to save and invest towards the longer term goals with an appropriate level of risk. Generally speaking, the more time you have, the more risk you could take with the possibility of generating higher returns. Time should not be underestimated as the power of compounding savings is enormous. For example, a 20-year-old would invest £100 in government bonds earning 3% on average each year for the next 40 years, will end up with about £326. However, investing in stocks and potentially more risky assets over the same period of time, but with an assumed high return of 10% per year, means that person would end up with just over £4,500. Quite a contrast. A plan that segregates your savings into those near-term and long-term goals can help you maximise your overall returns and help alleviate short-term risks.
I really hope you all enjoyed our episode today. If you're looking for ways to support us apart from listening to our show, you can leave a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also share and start a conversation on social media or your professional networks about what you've learned from any of our episodes. Thank you, and I hope to see some of you during my talk at TEDx Chelsea in New York this weekend. Thanks for tuning in, guys, and I'll catch you all again next week.
This show is produced by Human Group Media, an award-winning social good podcast company. Human Group Media works with thought leaders, brands, and organizations to inspire social change through the power of audio storytelling.